WHYY is proudly supported by Penn Medicine. From groundbreaking discoveries to life-saving care, Penn Medicine's innovation is helping to change lives, one moment, one treatment, one patient at a time.
This is Fresh Air. I'm Terry Gross. After our quick and decisive military victory over Iraq, President Bush said, "The specter of Vietnam has been buried forever in the desert sand of the Arabian Peninsula." But 16 years after the war, we haven't yet normalized relations with Vietnam. America is still leading an embargo against the country. James Fallow suggests the embargo is our way of punishing Vietnam for having won the war. It's the subject of his article in this month's edition of The Atlantic magazine. Fallows is The Atlantic's Washington editor. His most recent book, More Like Us, is about Japan, and he's now writing a book on the future of East Asia. Fallows also comments on the East for NPR's Morning Edition. James Fallows, welcome back to Fresh Air.
Nice to talk with you again, Terry.
So why do you think it's really our intention to punish Vietnam for having won the war?
I think it may be a little more perverse and a little more complicated than that. The case I try to make in this article about the embargo against Vietnam is that there are two places it hurts. One is Vietnam, of course, because the embargo is sufficient to keep the World Bank from building electric systems there and to keep sort of the normal development from taking place. So it's sufficient to punish Vietnam. It also is sufficient to punish us because basically, no one else is deterred by this embargo. And you see huge signs for Daewoo, you know, the Korean firm, and Japanese goods all over Vietnam. And the Italians and the French are there doing a rapid business. And I think what's happened is that from a purely rational point of view, it'd be very hard to make the case that 16 years later, which we should be having this embargo on Vietnam. But from an emotional point of view, no one can stand to face this subject again. I mean, the word Vietnam connotes such unpleasantness and torment and suffering for most Americans that for politicians in particular, who would have to change this law to remove the embargo, it's a completely no-win proposition. They can say Iraq for the next 100 years and people will cheer, but if you say Vietnam, no one even wants to think about it, so this perverse policy just kind of limps along.
But officially, the policy is to punish Vietnam for its violation of human rights. Right?
Yes, and it's the official rationale has evolved over the years. This Trading with the Enemy Act embargo was first slapped on against North Vietnam when we were fighting them in the 60s, and then applied to the whole country. And since 1979, it's been linked mainly to the affairs in Cambodia. Mm-hmm. Vietnam invaded there, everybody condemned them, and now, you know, 12 years after that, there's still pressure on Vietnam to get out of Cambodia. The difficulty here is that, you know, the Cambodian negotiations are, if anything, more complicated than those in the Middle East. It's just this impossible snarl of factions competing with each other, and most other governments think that Vietnam is now not the major bad guy there. If there's a major bad guy, it's probably China for keeping the Khmer Rouge going. And so that's the official rationale, that Vietnam is being so bad in Cambodia, we can't have any dealings with them. But I think there is a real emotional rationale below that.
So what are the terms of the embargo against Vietnam?
There are several. It's not possible for the government to forbid Americans to go there. For example, I spent the month of November there, and there are about some 10 or 15,000 Americans who go there each year. But under regulations from the Treasury Department and the State Department and the Commerce Department, basically everything else involving the U.S. and Vietnam is supposed to be prohibited. You can't make a telephone call to Vietnam from the U.S. You know, uniquely among the countries in the world, you can't call from the U.S. to Vietnam. You, if you're from any place except the U.S., you can use a Visa card in Vietnam, but Americans can't because Treasury Department regulations say the banks can't pay. In theory, nothing from Vietnam is supposed to be imported here. The U.S. has vetoed World Bank and IMF collaboration or interactions with Vietnam. So, and all these sort of economic impediments are, along with a complete lack of diplomatic relations. In Hanoi, there are embassies from basically every country, every major country except the U.S. So to the extent it's possible to think that Vietnam doesn't exist, that's the intention of the policy.
Vietnam is still trying to rebuild itself after the war. What effect is this embargo having on those rebuilding attempts?
It has an effect we couldn't really rationally wish because it is so harmful. Most developing countries in the world, including ones that we might object to in their policy even more than Vietnam, including Iraq, you know, before 6 months ago, rely on international agencies to get these big capital projects going. It's only through the World Bank that a poor country can build a road system, can build electric systems, can have food research and things like that. Because of the U.S. and Japanese veto on World Bank projects and IMF loans to Vietnam, this basic infrastructure can't get going. And so when you go there now, you see a lot of people who have the same kind of ferocity of will that the U.S. remembers from Vietnam and working very hard in small-scale enterprises, but the large-scale development of the country is really retarded below the level of all its neighbors.
What about the effect this is having on American businesses? American businesses must be losing out on potentially lucrative contracts in Vietnam.
I think this is the way the policy will change, if it does, because there, in Southeast Asia and Northeast Asia, including Japan and Korea, there is this sort of, you know, gold mine mentality among people who think that this is the chance to go in with no American competition whatsoever. There's an Australian businessman named Raymond Eaton, who's based in Bangkok, who goes around giving a speech basically every day to non-American audiences saying, this is your golden opportunity to get in without any competition from the U.S. Now, this has different shadings. For example, the Japanese in principle want to abide by the U.S. policy, this being sort of their main foreign policy goal. And so they discourage their companies from having overt involvement there. On the other hand, Japan is now surpassing the Soviet Union as the main exporter to Vietnam. Basically, all the manufactured goods there are either Japanese or Korean. Vietnam just gave some oil leases on a field that Mobil had discovered back in the old days of the war, and it went to a consortium of countries, not including the U.S. So I think this is what will finally get the policy changed, is complaints from U.S. business.
If you're just joining us, my guest is James Fallows. He's the Washington editor for The Atlantic Magazine, commentator for NPR's Morning Edition, and author of a recent book about Japan and a forthcoming book about East Asia. Are there absurd but creative ways of circumventing this boycott, this embargo against Vietnam?
There are indeed. I talked to a very innocent seeming Vietnamese manager of a shipping company in Ho Chi Minh City, the former Saigon, who was explaining that most of his sales were to the U.S. And I said, well, you know, how can this be? There's this embargo. And he said, oh, well, of course, you don't understand. They ship everything to Vancouver, and all the papers are changed there. And the things that came from Vietnam or come from Hong Kong or China or some other, you know, desirable country like that. And then they go on to California from Vancouver. That's the way some of the trade takes place. You get into a game of phone tag sometimes. When I was arranging with the Vietnamese ministries to have this visit, I would have to send faxes to a friend of mine in Bangkok, who would then send it from her fax machine to the ones in Hanoi. And so it's a peculiar situation.
The American goal in the Vietnam War was to keep South Vietnam free from communism, but we bombed South Vietnam quite a bit. From 1962 to 71, the United States sprayed 55 million acres of South Vietnam with herbicides. It's about one-seventh of the country. And many of the tropical forests are just grass now because of these herbicides. Do you think that the United States has a responsibility to help rebuild South Vietnam, which we participated in the destruction of?
Well, this may sound very strange. I don't think that item is very high on the Vietnamese list of priorities now for a stranger sounding reason.
The forest?
The forest and in general. And the point I'm getting at here is that what we think of as the Vietnam War is now less important to the Vietnamese than it is to us. I mean, to us, it is this historic watershed that changed our economy and our idea of foreign policy, et cetera, et cetera. To them, the phase of fighting with the Americans was part of a long episode of fighting with the Japanese before that and the French before that and the Chinese after it and the Cambodians after it. And there's been more or less constant warfare for a long time. And so the emotional content of this whole episode is much lower in Vietnam than it is in the U.S. Now, I'm sure it is a very poor country, and they would be happy for help they could get of any kind. There is a big conservation project underway called the Mekong River Project, which is supposed to do some of of this reforestation work. Actually, the main threat to the forest now is not so much the defoliants from 15 or 20 years ago, but the timber companies that are in there operating much more rapidly than before. So I think from Vietnam's point of view, they're not looking so much for reparations as they foolishly asked 15 years ago from the Carter administration, foolish because it threw the negotiations off the course, but rather just normal commercial interactions. That's the main thing they want.
Well, you know, I raised the question about the responsibility to rebuild South
right.
Vietnam, thinking in part two about, well, do we have a responsibility to eventually help build Iraq?
Well, this is part of the perplexity of these whole subjects. I would suspect that the U.S. will give money to rebuild Iraq before it gives money to rebuild Vietnam.
Because we won.
Because we won.
Yeah.
Because we won. And we can afford to think about it again and afford to be magnanimous. It is one of the twists of our national character that Americans are much better winners than losers. The Japanese often say the reverse about themselves, that they were very good losers after World War II and are not such good winners in economic war. And then the reverse is, I mean, for the U.S., we are much more likely to behave like decent people if we don't feel threatened and feel like we won.
If you're just joining us, James Fallows is my guest, and he is the author of a book about Japan. He's the Washington editor for The Atlantic magazine and a commentator for NPR's Morning Edition. We'll talk more after a short break. This is Fresh Air. James Fallows is my guest. So what are some of your observations, having watched the United States win the war in Iraq and see it as something that would help erase the bitter taste of our loss in Vietnam?
I think there is part of this much advertised cleansing effect that is good. I think it is good to have the military be in high esteem in the public in general. I did a lot of reporting in the military in the late 70s when they were at their trough after Vietnam, and that was a terrible situation for the country and for the Army, where people did not have any pride in what they were doing because they felt despised by the country as a whole. And so it's good. One sub-reason why it's good to have the military feeling better, I think, is that many of the values that people of every political stripe would like more of in America as a whole are now best exemplified in the military. It is racially the most open part of American society. It is becoming much more open between men and women. It's one of the parts of American society where sort of the me ethic and the 80s money ethic has not taken hold because it can't, where people need to have some team spirit and things like that. So I think that is good. It is probably good for the U.S. to feel that it's not just declining and collapsing in all fronts. However, I think the sort of triumphal reaction of the last several weeks is dangerous for several reasons. One is, this was a very peculiar kind of war we fought. If you happened to have signed up for the military before the war started, or to have signed a contract to go into the reserves, then you were affected by this war. You were in Saudi Arabia for a long time, you were exposed to risks, your family was disrupted, etc. If you weren't part of that group, this war did not touch you at all. You know, we didn't pay for it, the gasoline prices didn't go up, we didn't have to conserve anything, we didn't have to do anything that people normally do during wars. And so to act as if this were a tremendous demonstration of national resolve, it seems to me wishing that something were true rather than having it be true. I would have felt better if the president had said, okay, we've shown that we can do things in a military way. We know there are other things that we need to do. And so today I'm having a national defense gasoline tax. It'll pay first for this war, and then it'll pay for all the money we've been borrowing. We're going to have other things which everybody knows we need to do, but we've been waiting for some kind of prod. And so that, I think, is there's a danger of thinking that, you know, all our national woes are washed away. To just one other point, that Great Britain, you know, it has basically won every war it's gotten into since its involvements with the U.S. 200 years ago, with a few minor exceptions. But basically, it's constantly won its military engagements and yet steadily diminished in its sense of sort of power in the world. And this can be an example to us all.
Do you think that the countries in the coalition will be trying to punish Japan for contributing only money to the war?
I don't know. I think that everybody in Japan is asking exactly that question. One way to answer it is that I spent a lot of time following the debate about this money, and 99.5% of the arguments about whether or not Japan should spend money had nothing to do with Saddam Hussein. They had everything to do with public opinion in the U.S. That mm-hmm. is, how much money will be expected of us? How much money will it take so that we are not criticized? I think Japan has now come up with enough money. They're putting up in all, or they've promised in all, some $13 billion that I think that will look like a lot of money. On the other hand, I think their stance as an international leader has suffered. It's going to come in for severe reconsideration, because here you have the second most powerful economy in the world that simply was not able to participate and was not able to decide what to do, which is the distinction between it and Germany. I think that Germany decided and Japan couldn't decide through the months of this conflict what role it was supposed to play.
We know in terms of the Cold War, the comparison is always that the United States spent all of its money after World War II building up its military, and Japan spent its time and money building up its consumer industry, so Japan came out ahead economically. But in the war in the Middle East, the United States used that military that it had been building up and is now kind of repositioning itself in the Middle East, and it stands to gain a lot more political power, not to mention a greater economic base. So does that make a case for the United States having been right in building up its military in the intervening years?
I think that if you wanted to argue sheer economic efficiency, it would be hard to say that the U.S. has come out ahead economically by what it's done. There is a more gimlet-eyed version of the same case you could make for the U.S. now, which is that the comparative advantage the U.S. has over Japan in sort of international rivalry now comes down to things like pop culture, which America dominates around the world, the higher education system, which is very attractive in the U.S. People come from around the world to go into our universities, and the military. That in Asia, what makes people pay attention to the U.S. is those things and the Seventh Fleet, the fact that the U.S. has ships every place and Japan does not. And I think in the Middle East is becoming part of the same thing. And so in a somewhat more hard-eyed calculation, we may say, well, as our relative economic power diminishes, one influence we retain is this diplomatic and military influence. And that is not Woodrow Wilson speaking, but I think it is the way the world now works.
I'm interested in hearing a little bit more about your recent trip to Vietnam. You were there in November. What are some of the things that you saw that really surprised you, that were really different from what you were expecting to see?
I'd been there about 3 years before that, and what struck me then is how poor the place was compared to anywhere else in Southeast Asia. The only place that was comparable to it was Burma. And in Burma, you have the feeling of a place that's just frozen in amber and hasn't stirred in a long, long time. In Vietnam, you had the sense of ambitious people with the lid on them, the lid mainly of their own system, but also the international isolation. In the 3 years since then, there has been a lot of change. 3 years since I first went there. The government is now preaching an East European-style liberalization, and so you see it in sometimes effective and sometimes pathetic ways. The pathetic way is that it looks to me as if everybody who has a house in Hanoi has tried to convert it into a nightclub. And so with this flickering power system, you see these little tiny 1-watt neon bulbs or little 1-watt Christmas tree-type bulbs around the window saying, Café de Hanoi, and they all have, probably in all of Hanoi, there are maybe 1,000 VCR machines, each one of them in one of these little nightclubs. So people are literally selling Saigon beer to each other in these little nightclubs. There's also in the south of Vietnam, in the former Saigon, you see a lot of entrepreneurship now that you wouldn't have that I wouldn't have expected, and it's largely from the Taiwanese who are coming in and building new buildings. It has the standard kind of Asian construction style where a high-rise building is going up with bamboo scaffolding. You see these guys climbing on the bamboo, with their toes holding on. So I guess it is surprising to see first what a great difference there is still between the south and north of Vietnam. They still seem like two different countries, and how business seems to be getting off the ground more in the south. I suppose the other thing that would be surprising to most Americans is to go to Hanoi and see how beautiful it is. It's essentially a French provincial city that I'm sure was bombed a lot, but it's not bombed in ways that are now visible. And it's like a preserved French provincial city of the 1930s with people riding bicycles all around.
What's something you did in Vietnam that's really out of character for you, but you were in a different culture and you did it?
I was going to this is a little embarrassing, but...
I'm glad I asked.
I went to the Club International in Saigon, which is as I didn't fully realize before I went there, one gigantic whorehouse. You have these... the light bulb started to go on in my mind when I walked in this place with the music going at 5,000 decibels, and there were probably 10 or 15 other Caucasian men in there like me, and maybe 20 or 30 Japanese or Korean looking men, and about 5,000 young Vietnamese women, and the fee to get in there, which is, I should point out that almost all commerce in Vietnam is denominated in dollars. You pay in U.S. dollars for everything you do, and it costs like $2 to get in, which is a lot of money in Vietnam. So I wondered, there's this prosperous middle class in Hanoi in Ho Chi Minh City of all these young women who can afford the $2. And gradually my synapses came into focus, and I realized what was going on. But that was something that was, I hasten to say, out of character for me, and I won't go on in my narrative, but it was interesting to see.
Okay. I have one last question for you. You've been studying Vietnam, Japan, other countries in the East. But having looked at Vietnam and Japan, you've looked at the aftermath of our wars against both countries. And I wonder if that's led you to think about how our war against Iraq was, in a military sense, very short, but that the political, economic, health after effect of this war might be very, very long-lasting.
I wish I had thought to put it that way, because that's a very, very good way of putting it. The American wars in Japan and Korea were essentially the best things that happened to those countries. I mean, I think that is the conventional wisdom in both those places, and they cleared the decks in various ways, set the stage for phenomenal development. That was not the case in Vietnam for reasons we've been discussing, but yes, the aftermath goes on for a long time, and I'm sure it will in the Middle East.
James Fallows, thanks a lot for talking with us.
Thanks for giving me the chance.
James Fallows is the Washington editor for The Atlantic Magazine, a commentator for National Public Radio's Morning Edition, and author of the book More Like Us, which is about Japan, and author of a forthcoming book on the Far East. I'm Terry Gross, and this is Fresh Air.